Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, Emily McCord has this week's Politics Ohio. Wittenberg professor and poet Steve Brody pays a visit to Conrad's Corner. Up first, last week, Sarah Buckingham reported on child sex trafficking in Ohio. The piece featured Dr. Celia Williamson, a member of the Ohio Trafficking in Persons Study Commission. We've got more with Dr. Williamson today. She told Sarah how in 1993, just getting a dialogue on sex trafficking started was an uphill battle.
It was not the popular thing to do. It was very, very stigmatizing work. People at that time were saying, why are you doing this? Why are you throwing your career away on people? Like, do you have a past in prostitution? Have you? Is that why you're interested in this? And so there was a lot of stigma toward me as a professional, and a lot of doors closed and a lot of barriers to even conducting a workshop on the issue. When I started to do one of my earlier workshops, I went to the Toledo Public Library, and they told me no, I couldn't use any of the titles that I presented to them because it was offensive. And they didn't want me to use the word prostitution. And so I explained to them about, taking away a voice and how, you know, libraries fight against censorship. And they still said, yes, we understand that, but no, you cannot use any title that would suggest that women are in the sex trade, let alone the slave sex trade. And so I ended up calling the workshop Sex in the City, and which I really did not like that title because it conjured up women in high heels and in New York City, and that's not what I was trying to explain. And so I didn't even know if people knew what they were coming to, because the title of the workshop did not fit what I was trying to explain. And so it was very much a movement that was back, sort of models the early days in domestic violence advocacy, where people didn't want to discuss that. They said, well, that, between what happens with the man and a woman in their home, that's their business. And so we should not be invading someone's personal space and trying to legislate what happens in the privacy of one's home. And so later, the advocates, of course, people learned, well, abuse is not a part of your privacy, and, victimization is not something we're going to tolerate. And then they began to change systems, and then systems started bringing charges, and systems started standing with victims. Now, we have a long way to go in domestic violence for sure, but trafficking is back where domestic violence was, and traveling the same path toward human rights that domestic violence did.
Why do you think that the issue is getting so much publicity and awareness is so much higher now than it was back in the 90s?
I think we created a tipping point, and it took a lot of work, a lot of advocates. We had, we've been doing a national conference. This is our eighth year that we've completed one. So we've been educating the national community for a very long time. We have about 300. This year we had 400, but typically we have 300 attendees, 45 presenters. We represent 8 countries that attend. And so we've been building awareness for a long time. In 2000, when the government passed the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, based on a lot of advocacy and some research from the University of Pennsylvania, ever since that point, the government has stepped behind this issue to say we're going to have a national campaign called Rescue and Restore. We're calling on governmental and non-governmental agencies to become educated, become aware, and rescue victims and restore victims. We're going to label this modern-day slavery. We're going to call these people victims. And once the government stood behind it, then people began to get educated, and then around 2004, 2005, people started taking the issue seriously. They started using the appropriate language. Now our country has decided we're not going to tolerate slavery. We get it. And now you see this sort of surge, which is wonderful.
And what's the scope of the problem here in Ohio and also maybe in Toledo specifically?
Well, in Ohio, we've estimated we're the first state to provide the country with estimates. So we estimate that there are almost 3,000 domestic minors who are at risk of being trapped in the child sex trade. Of those, there are about 1,078 any given year that are trapped in the sex trade. 85% of our kids in Ohio are recruited here and then trafficked to other places where the demand is larger. We have about 783 foreign victims that are brought into Ohio, and so for labor or sex trafficking adults and children. And so with Ohio, when you're talking about domestic minors who are born and raised here and trapped in the sex trade, they're recruited here and they're taken to other places where there's a high demand. When you're talking about foreign victims, they're being brought into the state and being sold into the labor or the sex trade.
And where do those numbers come from? Is that based on arrests or rescues, or how do you really measure a problem like this?
Well, it is very difficult, and that's why no one's ever done it except us. But it takes a lot of thinking, some statistical models to provide an estimate. Now, in Toledo, we have already, or the FBI, Innocence Lost Task Force, has already identified 90-plus kids, so almost 100. So if we have an estimate of 1,078 domestic minors, and in Toledo alone, we've almost found 100, and Toledo has 88 counties, then we're pretty sure that our estimate is conservative and low. But what's happening is throughout the country, we know that if the government is estimating 14,500 to 17,500 foreign victims are brought into the country any given year, and according to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, 100,000 domestic minors are trapped in the sex trade. We know that our issue right now is let's identify domestic minors trapped in the sex trade. And that's something our government has recently tapped into. They've been putting a lot of money into foreign trafficking, foreign victims that are here. And then we find out, wow, we have a much bigger problem with domestic minors. And some of the issue is, while the government, the federal government under the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, understands that anybody under 18 years old that is involved in prostitution or involved in the sex trade is by definition the victim of child sex trafficking. We don't need to prove force, fraud, or coercion. They can say, I love it, I like it, that's what I want to do. Our federal government understands that they're minors. They cannot consent to their own abuse. However, across the country, every single day, we arrest these kids. We rescue them, and we incarcerate them. And somehow we justify in our minds that that's okay, because we're saving them, see, and we're protecting them, okay? That's what we hide behind. And so, you know, I give the analogy that if you had a burglary at your house, and somebody stole your things, and I'm afraid, as a police officer, I'm afraid that they're going to come back, and that burglary is going to turn into a robbery. And you're going to get hurt. So I'm going to incarcerate you for your own protection, right? No. Hell to the no. There'd be so many attorneys that adults would call, but we do that every day to kids, and we call it protection. We take their rights, their civil liberties, and people stomp on them, and we don't care because we're protecting them. And what happens is the kids who are trafficked across this country are disproportionately girls. They're disproportionately kids of color. They're disproportionately sexual minorities. So what we're indeed practicing is institutionalized racism, sexism, and homophobia. And the country seems to be all right with that. And so each state has to come forward and pass its own anti-trafficking law. And many say, we're going to leave that part out. If you're under 18, if you're 16 or 17, you know what you're doing. So if you're 14 or 15, we'll call you a victim. But if you're 16 or 17, you're really going to have to prove your victimization because we don't believe it. That's an issue in this country. There seems to be this blame the victim, this continued deeply rooted sexism and racism that continues in this country. And what happens is the three largest illegal enterprises are drugs, human trafficking, and guns. If I'm a human trafficker, if I want to get an illegal enterprise, which one do I want to choose? drugs and guns? No, because every time I sell them, I have to go get more drugs and guns. But if I sell people, I can resell my product over and over. I don't have to go buy more product. Nobody understands what's going on. Nobody understands that it's an industry, it's an enterprise with many players, so they're going to arrest one link in the chain. I'm going to replace that link in the chain, continue my enterprise. If they do find out that I'm involved in this, they're going to arrest my victim. They're not going to understand what I'm doing, and then I'm long gone before anybody even understands what's happening. Now, we know the highest risk factors are kids who are runaways, homeless, who have been victims of child abuse or anything that has created a vulnerability. Not necessarily poor kids, although poverty is, you know, creates high vulnerability. So if I'm a runaway, and so far in our study, preliminary results, you know, 66% of kids who have been trafficked in our state have been runaways. So what do we do in our state when there's a runaway, or across the country for that fact? If somebody runs away and they're, let's say, 13 to 17 years old, I'm more likely to say that they ran away if they're missing. Okay, if a 7-year-old ends up missing, there's going to be an Amber Alert. There's going to be, you know, everybody's going to stop what they're doing. Stores are going to close down and people are looking on the highways. You know, if I'm 14, I'm 16, and I'm missing, people are going to say I ran away. Local police are going to come to my house and they're going to ask me, you know, they're going to ask my parents, when was the last argument? How many times have they run away before? Because they're building the argument to say this kid's a runaway. Then police don't look. You know, they engage in passive enforcement. There are about 15,000 runaways in Ohio a year. We don't have the resources to be looking for runaways. So if I see some kids standing on a corner or whatever, I ask them, you know, aren't you supposed to be in school? Let me see some ID or whatever. But I'm not actively looking for this kid. Okay, 85% are taken out of the city anyway. So if I have people doing outreach, homeless, runaway kid outreach, they're doing it in their own community. All right, these kids aren't in their community. So who's looking for them? So you have the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children that connects the dots nationally. Well, if you look up how many kids they have listed on the National Center's website, you won't see over 100. And I said there are 15,000 kids. So what business do you want to be in? I want to be in the business where nobody knows what the hell is going on, where I can make the most money I can, where prosecutors don't even understand the law to be able to bring charges if local law enforcement even understands that this is an enterprise.
What about adult women? Are the majority of victims underage, or is it the case that a woman who's over 18 is considered to be of her own free will?
Yeah, it's very, even though the federal law says that if you're over 18 and you're involved in the labor or the sex trade, that we have to prove that force or fraud or coercion happened. Then we're going to call you a victim of human trafficking. But what that relates to in real terms, in reality, is that we're going to focus on kids. And you're going to have a difficult time finding or defending a case or prosecuting a case where there's an adult victim, adult domestic victim of sex trafficking. We just don't focus our energies there. And that's a shame, because a lot of the continued victims were victims when they were younger. A lot of the adult women that we are saying are choosing to go out there are not human trafficking victims. They're prostituted women, prostituted now by poverty, drugs, earlier trauma from being trafficked. Our country is not willing to look at the continued trauma of adult women and how their lives get destroyed. You know, we did a study with 1,000 women offenders, and we carved out those that had been involved in prostitution from those that had been involved in general crime. And we saw a statistically significant difference, which means not by chance, that these women's lives were tremendously altered in a negative way in terms of health and in terms of emotional and mental health.
And now what about the customers?
Oh, customers. Well, we're not allowed to talk about that part. It seems that they're, you know, this is a business. You know, it's supply, demand, and distribution. The distributors are the traffickers, supplier the victims, demander the customers. You'll be hard-pressed to go and look at any state law to find where they have focused on demand. You will be hard-pressed to find any coalition, human trafficking coalition. These are the good guys that are focused heavily on demand. But you can't combat the problem. You can't reduce the problem unless you work on supply and demand and distribution. You can't. I suspect that everyone feels compassion toward the victim, and they all want to run toward the victim. They all want to have programs for the victim. But they don't understand that if you take a victim out, there's another victim the next day. But if you end demand, you stop it. You stop the problem.
And what about the new state law that was passed last year to create a second-degree felony charge for human trafficking? Is that having any effect, do you think?
I think that was a big and bold move. I'm so proud of the state for doing that. I mean, I think I cried and cried because it was so wonderful to, you know, it took a while for me to understand why a bill would fail several times. It took a while for me to understand how state legislators could contemplate whether slavery was a good idea or not. I didn't understand that. I thought if you're a legislator, that's one thing that should be pretty clear. But of course, I don't understand how politics works. Politics is a tricky thing, and it takes a long time, and it takes a lot of negotiating. And what I understand is that having a brand new law is the hardest thing you can do. And so to pull that off is a really big feat. And so, you know I credit Teresa Fetter with that hard work. I mean, she was burning up the highway, running up and down, and it was holidays last year, and she was still at work when everybody else was trying to go home, and she was just working day and night, and, she's amazing. And so, you know, I was, of course, like, it needed to be done yesterday, you know, so... And so, you know, everybody has their stance. And she picked the ball up and she ran with it. And now she's doing the safe harbor legislation, which will prevent our state from arresting the victim, from arresting the wrong person, and not having the kid go through juvenile court, but go through child welfare for care instead of commitment, you know. And so that... that's a state saying that, yes, our children are our most precious resource.
Dr. Celia Williamson with the Ohio Trafficking in Persons Study Commission speaking with Sarah Buckingham. This is Why So Weekend.
Welcome to Conrad's Corner. From time to time, I do interviews with local poets. My guest today is a professor at Wittenberg, a resident of somewhere near Cedarville, Steve Brody.
Conrad, it's always a pleasure to be talking with you.
Well, good. It's a pleasure to have you here, Steve. And you recently had a little bit of fame in Dayton. You won a first prize in the senior category.
I did. That's my 30 seconds in the sun, I think.
Yeah. This was for the Dayton Metro Library Annual Poetry Contest. And it's interesting. I think 5 of the 6 senior winners are people who are read and occasionally do interviews on WYSO.
That's right.
And the subject of the category you were in was seniors, and you were going to do some poems about seniors and other family members?
I thought that was appropriate.
So what are you going to start with?
Well, I'd like to start with one that's about my father, toward the end, called After the Bypass. After the bypass, he was half aware as we dragged ourselves to his bed. "Go," he said, "get out of here before you get it too." I knew it was just the drug wearing off. Still, I left the room. Months have passed. His heart is strong. But dust they pumped back in with his life coats his mind. He fights through fog he sees but can't see through. "How are you, Pop?" I ask when I stop by. He pecks me lightly on the cheek. His gaze is meek, grave as a schoolboy regretting his grades. "Put some eggs in the freezer," he says, and restless wanders off. I hear him at his desk, opening and closing drawers. Mom is storming. I did deviled eggs, since I knew you were coming. Sam, I said, put the eggs in the basement fridge with the pie. She starts. Oh, my, you don't think he froze the pie, too? I do. It's okay, Mom. I'll thaw the eggs. They'll be all right. They come from the microwave, warm and yellow. Whites wet as diapers. They squish with every bite. A whole bright plate of them, sound at the center, leaking life from each supporting cell.
Thank you, Steve. A very moving poem. And then where do we go from here?
Well, I have a couple of poems, if you'd care to hear them, about, oh, advancing middle age.
I remember that those days back then.
I'm beginning to remember them, too. One's called Week End, and there's a deliberate pun there. On top of everything, as he watched his team lose another close one, his son burst in for homework help, and though he taught it patiently and whispered to the boy just how he must proceed and what was right, his son would not perceive, but screamed in sudden rage. To his great surprise, the man felt answering anger rise from his chest to his ears like tide to the lunar load. It foamed from his head with the sound of God's own wave upon a rock-bound shore. If you won't understand this time, I will beat you so hard my enemies will fear me, he spoke, or thought. So his boy, eyes huge and floating, said, never mind, Dad, I'll work on it myself, and left him alone with the team losing yet another close one.
Now, today we happen to have your son in the studio with us, Steve. Did you ever really talk to him like that?
No, never did. I don't think I ever thought it either. So.
Okay.
So he seems to have grown up mostly normal.
So this is more of a poem of the imagination?
That's right.
But you do get feelings like this sometimes?
I think all parents probably do.
Yes, and sometimes towards students, too?
Maybe.
Maybe. Okay, what's the next one?
This one's called 50, meaning the age. Home again from school, absent these few weeks and worlds, my daughter took to watching me as if a homely thing gone strange, and after days of smiling, silent thought, proclaimed me elven, by which I hoped she meant in the high elven fortune ageless, not the shrunken, sharp-eyed slacker vexed with treachery and lost gold. I was struck as one who hears his fond delusions trumpeted by angels and preened for 3 days straight. Elven, yes, for I am half enmeshed in, half removed from life, whole though faded, wondering what is lost and what has grown. Mainly mythical myself, I claim my daughter's vision as my own.
I have to confess my ignorance here. I don't know who Elvin is or was.
I was talking about elves in the Lord of the Rings and the J.R.R. Tolkien stories.
That was good. All right. I think we have time for another vignette.
Oh, good. Well, this one's... Actually, I wrote in the spring, so you'll have to forgive the seasonality of it. This one's called Last Light. My job tonight is to watch the dog as he samples the scents of the yard. Keep him far from the flower bed newly laid, she said. But I find it's last light of this lovely June day. Just supper time. Toop time. Time then to lay old bones in bed. Instead, I'm lingering, dog is pleased, and I'm seized by a focus on something I know and can't yet say, here at the end of the day. There are flashes of insight in the tall grass, restless, grasping for truth to be found when they mate with it, new lights of awareness on high. Yes, it was always there, beyond the daily blues. And now comes a darkening clarity. Mate perhaps to morning's slow and muddied foretelling, silhouette of what is and must be. The dog wants his dinner. Me, I find I can finally taste the words.
Well, Steve, I thank you. I think you do have a taste for words. You might be getting old, but you older, but you obviously haven't lost your poetic touch.
Yeah, I'm hoping that's the last thing to go.
And I really appreciate your touch with words, your ability to write and to share it with us. I thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me.
Steve Brody.
Welcome to Politics Ohio. I'm Emily McCord, and Bill Cohen joins me today. He's with the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
There were a couple of polls released this week from Quinnipiac University. They're pretty telling about how Ohioans feel about several issues affecting the state. Let's start with fracking. Now, this poll comes out weeks after the state has shut down wastewater wells from the fracking process. It may be related to a series of earthquakes there. Bill, what do Ohioans think about this process?
Well, it depends on the exact question you ask them. If you ask them, do you generally like oil and gas drilling, and do you support the economic benefits of drilling over environmental concerns, they say, yes, we go for the drilling. We like the economic benefits. That's more important than environmental concerns. By a 2-to-1 margin, they say that. But then a minute later, you ask those same people, what about fracking in particular? Should there be a halt to fracking until there's more study of its environmental impact? And by a 3-to-1 margin, they say, yeah, that's a good idea. Let's have a halt to fracking. Kind of, it's very interesting how people, you know, they obviously, Ohioans want the jobs that that oil and gas drilling is bringing and may bring even more as more fracking is being done. But on the other hand, they're leery about environmental problems.
Quinnipiac released a poll also on the heartbeat bill, and that's the one that would ban abortions once a fetal heartbeat's detected, and that can be as early as 6 weeks into a pregnancy. And now this poll found that Ohioans are split on the bill. And how is that telling for this in the future? And if this was imposed, it could impose some of the strictest limits on abortion in the nation.
That's true. But as you say, Ohioans are virtually split down the middle on this. The interesting thing, though, is Democrats, basically 2-to-1, don't like the bill. Republicans, by 2-to-1 or more than 2-to-1, do like the bill. So backers of the heartbeat bill are going to those majority Republicans in the Ohio Senate and saying, look, Ohioans may be split, but your constituents, you are Republicans, and your constituents by a 2-to-1 margin like this bill. So stop holding it up and approve it just like the Ohio House did.
If indeed Republicans have this overwhelming support, what impact will this have on moving this bill forward?
It's hard to say because we've gotten the sense that the leadership of majority Republicans in the Senate are a little leery about this bill. After all, it seems to violate the thrust of Roe v. Wade, the 1973 U.S. Supreme Court ruling legalizing abortion. But backers are saying, look, we know it generally violates it, but that's the whole point.
Now, another poll. How about the election for 2012? Polling numbers show some good news for Mitt Romney.
In Ohio, they do. They showed him leading the pack in Ohio among all the GOP contenders with 27%. But the interesting thing is, in second and third place, Santorum and Gingrich, and if you combine their two totals, they would actually beat Romney. So I think one of the keys here, and it's the same thing nationally, are conservatives in the Republican Party going to unite behind one candidate? If they do, they might at least have a shot at Romney.
Now, how does Romney stack up against President Obama in the election?
Well, that's interesting. Romney, you match them up, and it's a virtual tie. I think Obama wins by 2 points. Obama beats most of the other Republicans by 8, 10, 12 points or so. It's interesting, whereas the poll shows Ohioans are not enamored with Obama at the moment. In fact, a majority or so, more people think he's doing a bad job than a good job. When you match him up with the Republicans, they think twice and say, well, maybe we better go with the president, even though we're not thrilled with him.
I do want to quickly touch on some other news this week. Governor John Kasich announced that he would deliver his State of the State address at a school in eastern Ohio rather than the State House. Bill, what's significant about that?
Well, it's unprecedented, at least in my 40 years or so down here. I've never seen that. Usually the governor gives his address in the House chamber and the state reps and state senators are there and the cabinet and so forth. But it may not be all that surprising that the governor wants to get out of the State House. First of all, he wants to highlight this well-performing public school in Steubenville. He also generally likes to get out of, you know, kind of the beltway kind of mentality as he sees it in Columbus. I think he wants to spotlight a small town, Ohio. Also, Steubenville is in the heart of fracking country. And I think he may want to highlight how Ohio can get a lot of jobs and economic boosts from fracking. So I think there are several reasons. Let me point out one more possible reason, although I can't read the governor's mind. State of the state address, his speech was interrupted in a way with the chanting. You could hear the chanting downstairs from union activists, hundreds of them who were upset about the new collective bargaining bill. I think the governor remembers that, and he'd kind of like to get away from the statehouse this time around.
I've been speaking with Bill Cohen from the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for this week's edition of WISO Weekend. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks to all of our guests, and thanks for joining us on member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, a broadcast service of Antioch University. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.